This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you have an animal behavior question for us, we are ready to take your calls at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to your calls this hour, we'll also share another topic. Right, Patricia?
That's right. We're going to talk about punishment.
Ooh.
But it won't be punishing. We're going to talk about what punishment is, because a lot of people get confused about it, and why, in most cases, it may not be the best way to train our pets to do what we want them to do.
Okay. And we'll also welcome a guest to talk about what it takes to become a wildlife rehabilitator who helps injured animals return to the natural habitats. That's all coming up. But first, let's take some calls at 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Rebecca from Washington, D.C.
Rebecca, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you, guys. I just want to say first that I really enjoy listening to your show every week. I listen in, and I just, all the advice on all the different types of animals is just awesome.
No, thank you.
It just intrigues me so much. I actually don't have a pet currently, and that's partially why I'm calling. I am interested in getting a cat, and one of the sort of requirements of me getting a cat is that it needs to get along with my parents' cat, because as we spend time together during the holidays and, you know, we'll be pet sitting for each other, I'm sort of hoping to get a cat that will get along with their, I guess he's about 5 month old tuxedo cat named Houdini. And I just don't know really what to look for in terms of like age or sex of cat or demeanor or whatnot.
That's a really good question. You know, I saw a great talk by Kim Berry. She's a PhD ethologist and did a lot of her PhD on cat-cat interactions and did a lot of work, reviewed some of the literature out there and other research on cats getting along, so blended families, you know, which is a very common call we get here on the radio show. And here's one of the things she discovered that I found so interesting. Unlike dogs, sex didn't seem to matter as much. Now, I know cases where there are like two male cats who don't get along.
Yeah.
But in general, gender was far less important than there were really two basic
things
factors.
Here.
Yeah.
Okay.
That influenced whether cats got along or not. And one was age. So this is great that your parents' cat is only 5 months old. Because that's really young, much more flexible, much more adaptable. So getting another young cat is a very good idea. Or if you find an older cat, there's so many at shelters that need homes. There's so many wonderful older cats at shelters that need homes. If you can find one who has a known background, the cat got along very, very well with other cats, bringing them into a resident, you know, young 5 month old, that has a pretty, you know, pretty good
chance.
Probability, yeah, of working out all right. But personality and time turned out to be the other two hugely important factors. One is it just takes time. Cats are just slow. They're just not dogs. They're just slower. So you want to ease them into interacting, do all the sort of standard ways of introducing two unfamiliar cats together. And the other is personality. You know, not breed, not sex, just what kind of cat do you have? And there's some cats, there are a lot of people listening who have those cats who are just like, oh, I love my cat friend, and we cuddle together, and we lick each other's heads, and we sleep up together. And there are other cats who 2 years later are either in the basement or still hissing. You know? So part of the issue is going to be what this five-month-old is like. Might want to go to a shelter, explain your problem to them, and they might let you do a kind of a controlled interaction, but they could help you select a cat who is known to do well around other cats.
That's great advice, I think. And Rebecca, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling.
Good luck. Let us know. Send us an email and let us know.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we received an email from Barbara in Manassas, Virginia, and she has a 4-year-old golden retriever who is about to be reunited with her sister. They've been apart for 2 years. The dogs were best buddies. They'd run freely, romp, wrestle within Barbara's electrical fence, and she wants to know, will the dogs remember each other when they reunite, and is there an optimal way to handle the initial reunion?
Oh, a bunch of good questions. The probability that they will remember each other is very high. If one of the dogs is uncomfortable greeting unfamiliar dogs, then you do want to manage it a little bit. You know, if one dog goes screaming up to the other one, sort of jumps on the other's head before he has a chance to figure out who it is, things might not go well, you know. And then it's like, wait, no, you know each other. Honest, you do. So what you might want to do is set up a situation where they are on leashes or with a fence in between them. Which often can go very, very well unless you have a dog who's one of those fence fighters. But otherwise, get a fence in between them. Let them sniff each other with a fence in between. Let them go like, oh, it's you. And then you know, if you're in a safe area, fenced area that's safe, just let them go and let them play and videotape it. You can watch it forever. It's so fun to watch those kind of greeting play interactions.
It sounds wonderful. And I agree with you. I think it's going to work out just fine.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of – I've seen one piece of research on whether puppies, grown puppies, remembered the breeder, the person, you know, mm-hmm. different species. And it was a poster paper, so it wasn't extensive. The suggestion was indeed they did. They spent a significantly more time with a person who had been the breeder and raised them up to 7 weeks than they did with other people in an unfamiliar setting. So, you know, if they can remember a person when they were only 7 weeks old and then a year or so later, surely they can remember their sister that they played with for 2 years.
Okay. And how do people send their questions in?
We love it when you do. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org. Or, you know, you can go on our website. Just go to callingallpets.org and talk to us from there.
Absolutely. And you can call us, too, at 1-800-462-7413 if you have a question. And we have somebody online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sally from Traverse City, Michigan.
Sally, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
I have an 11-month-old Cairn Terrier who becomes extremely excited when he sees a bird or a turkey or a squirrel or anything that moves outside the window. We live in a wooded area. There's not much going on other than birds and squirrels and things.
I was going to say.
And he's tearing up the windowsills and the walls, and he yips and he cries, and he gets very, very revved up and agitated.
What have you tried? What do you do now?
Well, we've been trying to catch him and give him a timeout for 5 to 10 minutes in a quiet, crated back bedroom. And that calms him for 2 minutes, maybe.
Yeah.
When he comes back out, you know, he's good for a couple of minutes and walks around, and then he's back at the window again.
This would be a classic case where I think redirection would be the best way to go. And by that, what I mean is taking all that energy he has, because it's in there, and you're not going to, you know, you can calm it down for a minute or two, but it's just going to start building back up again. And he's a terrier. He was bred to go after little small animals. So,
right.
So, and he's 11 months old. I mean, you've got three strikes against you, basically. This is the perfect storm of tear your hair out behavior. So here's what I do. I would take that energy and I would teach him to go get a toy. So if he looks out the window and he sees a squirrel, I want you to go. What's his name?
Will.
Willie. And then you're going to squeak his squeaky toy, or you're going to shake something that has food treats in it that makes a little rattle, and he's going to turn around and you're going to go, oh, where's your toy? And you're going to squeak his squeaky toy, and you're going to play tug-of-war with him with his squeaky toy.
Okay.
And so basically the idea is that every time he sees an animal outside, as quickly as you can, you're going to turn him away from that, and you're going to teach him to go get a toy. Now, timing is really important here.
Yeah.
Because if you wait until he's like screaming, that's good, Larry. Good. If he's barking like Larry and he does that too long, and then you redirect him, then you're rewarding him for doing all that barking. So the trick is in the timing. So when you can't be watching him, which is probably going to be at least half your life, don't hesitate to have him with you. You know, he's little. You can leash him to your belt, have him with you, have him in a crate, have him in a room away from all those beautiful windows.
Okay.
All those beautiful windows are so good for us primates and so problematic for people with dogs. The architects take note.
Oh, good luck. Thank you very much for calling.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sally. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll learn about punishment and why it might not be the best approach to training your pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, you frequently talk about positive reinforcement, and you rarely talk about punishment as a way to train our pets. I'd love to have you tell us why you take this approach to training.
Well, you know, let me start by defining punishment, because that's a word that means different things to different people. The popular use of the term usually refers to something bad, right? You know, aversive, or negative, or coercive, like yelling at your dog for barking or jerking on the leash for pulling. But psychologists use the term punishment to mean anything that decreases the frequency of a behavior. So that isn't necessarily something aversive, at least not to us. So it could be, punishment could be, oh, maybe somebody gives a dog a leash correction because the dog growled, which, by the way, might stop the growling, but not the motivation behind it, which is why I don't recommend it. But punishment could also be when somebody goes pat, pat, pat on top of the dog's head because the dog came when called. But dogs don't tend to like that. So it could be punishment because the dog is less likely to come the next time he's called. Dogs may like petting, but they don't always like pat, pat, pat. So the owner thinks he's being gentle and kind, but it's a great example of punishment because the dog is less likely to come when called the next time.
So it goes to show that even if it seems positive to us, it could still be a punishment for the animal.
Exactly. And here, just to confuse things even more, most punishment is actually correctly referred to, psychologists call it positive punishment. That's a term I would love for them to have not started.
Get rid of that one.
It's confusing, but what they mean by positive punishment is that something is added. You add something into the system. So you yell at your dog, or you jerk on the leash, or you pat them on top of the head, or you use a squirt bottle. The reason I don't recommend that kind of punishment very often is because it's either ineffective, it's often ineffective, or it has potentially serious side effects. Let me give you an example. Well, that one we talked about of a dog growling. Say he's afraid of unfamiliar people. That's what caused the growl. So the next time somebody comes up, your dog's going to skip the warning growl. Okay, I was punished for growling, so I'm not going to growl anymore. But he's going to end up snapping or even, you know, heaven forbid, biting because the fear is still there.
I gotcha.
So that's problematic. But, you know, even punishment that doesn't lead to that kind of problems is not often a good idea because it doesn't teach an animal what you do want them to do. You know, say you have a dog who jumps up on visitors. I know no one out there has ever had a dog who's done that. So your dog jumps up on Aunt Nellie or something and you say, no. Well, that doesn't teach your dog what you want your dog to do.
So it sounds like punishment is a bad idea overall, and you don't recommend it.
Well, you know, just to confuse things even more,
confuse it.
I do recommend it sometimes, but I usually recommend something, get ready, called negative punishment, which sounds horrible, doesn't it? But it's not. Don't let that negative part fool you. Next week, I'm going to talk about how negative punishment can actually get positive results.
I can't wait till next week. Let's do it right now.
No,
I'm going to have to wait. Okay.
You got to wait.
Well, all right. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that on next week's show, and we will do that next week. But for now, we want your calls. Give us a call at 1-800-462-7413, and here is another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Patricia and Larry. This is Dennis in De Pere, Wisconsin.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a little one-year-old Schnauzer Bichon mix, and he's very obedient. He's very loving. He's a true lap dog. But at nighttime, when it's time for him to go in his crate, he loves it in his crate. He's probably in there right now. But when he goes in at night, he becomes extremely aggressive to the point of we're scared of him.
Really?
Yes.
So when you're putting him in, is it when you shut the door?
Yeah. If we go near him, he'll growl. And when you shut the door, it's a good thing that it's there. Our fingers would be missing.
But if the door stays open and you go near the crate, is he aggressive?
He growls.
He does.
Gives you the warning.
He's probably thinking the door's closing soon.
Could be. Stay away. But he loves his crate, you say?
He does.
Okay. So, you know, this is not an uncommon problem. I see it in more breeds, actually, in some certain breeds more than others. But, you know, any dog's capable of doing it. Here's some things I would try is one, let's speculate that this is basically resource guarding. This is mine. This is my home. This is my territory. You can't have it. And that's exacerbated because I'm trapped.
And he'll do that with food, too, now and then.
The plot thickens. So here's the good news. There's some procedures you can do, which can be sort of fun, actually, for everybody, that often can turn this around. I do suggest that you're very thoughtful about bringing somebody in. Anytime you have the potential of aggression, you've obviously gotten started here, that you're really smart to get a coach, you know? So you might want to look around in your area for a trainer who knows how to use operant and classical conditioning. But so here's what I would get started with. I would start with a kind of an classical conditioning paradigm. But basically, you're teaching him, rather than the emotion of, oh, no, he's coming towards my food or my crate and he's going to take it away. It's like, oh, boy, here he comes. I love it when he comes towards my crate because when he does, I get something really good. So the basics are pretty simple if you do it right. And you know, the fix is in the details here. So doing it right means is what you're going to do is you're going to teach him that one step towards the crate when he's in it means something good is going to happen. So that step towards the crate means he can anticipate something good. So you let him go in his crate, stand 10 feet away from it, take one step toward it, and then toss a piece of little tiny piece of wonderful treat into his crate. And then you stand there, let him eat it. Then you take one more step forward and toss a piece of food into his crate. And then turn and go back. And then repeat that, not getting any closer than, say, you know, 3 to 4 feet in one session. Don't start that when you actually have to shut the door when he needs to go to sleep at night.
Sure.
Okay? Uh-huh. So just make this like a little game. It's like the crate. Do you want to play your crate game? Do you want to play your crate game? And you can do the same thing with food. You set up situations where you have control over whether you how close you have to get to him, how much food he has, or how many toys or resources he's protecting. And so gradually over time, you're going to change his emotion from, oh, no, I might lose what I have, to, oh, boy, I'm going to get something better. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Good luck, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling.
And thank you for your help.
Yeah, good luck. And don't hesitate to get a coach in a situation like this, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Patricia, we received an email from a listener named Leslie who wants your take on the trainability of animals. And here's what she writes. I've always wondered what determines whether an animal can be trained. Is it intelligence, the wish to please, or is it something else? I've owned both cats and dogs were far easier to train. Still, cats can be trained to use a litter box and to come when called. The ape family is supposedly intelligent, but I've never heard of anyone house training an ape or getting them to act socially correct. What do you think?
That is such a good question.
It is.
How long do we have, Mueller?
More.
I could talk all hour about this. This is a great question, and here's some quick responses. There are a lot of factors that go into it, and often we focus on intelligence, but that's just one of them, you know?
Yep.
One of the factors about whether an animal learns something is whether they're motivated to learn it. So intelligence has to do with, can they put A together with B? You know, can they learn to be house trained, or can they learn to do a trick? And that's often associating a cue that you give them with an action or a behavior or a posture, something like that, with a reward. So intelligence is one aspect, but motivation is a whole other one. You know, how motivated are they to do something? And you can, by the way, you can train apes to be house trained.
Oh, and you can.
Yes, and you can train them to do all kinds of things. The issue becomes one of other behavior and motivation. You know, chimpanzees, for example, in the wild can be quite aggressive, and they're also very emotional, and they don't have a lot of emotional inhibition, you know, not real good at chilling out sometimes. And so the problem with working with adult chimpanzees, especially adult male chimpanzees, is that you get on the wrong side of them. They wake up on the wrong side of the bed one day and they can kill you. You know, so you can train them to do all kinds of things, but if you have a little bad day, you know the teacher is gone, kind of thing. So there's genetic predisposition. That's another factor. It's a lot easier to house train animals who are very specific about where they go to the bathroom. It's harder to train an ungulate, a hoofed animal, for example, because they tend to just sort of lift their
go
tail
wherever they are.
I mean, my sheep literally will be lying down, resting, and they'll defecate. Right there.
They'll poop right there.
They'll poop right there. And then, you know, they get up and there it is. And, you know, just grass anyway, you know, big deal. But so it's a lot harder to train an animal to be house trained, for example, to do that than it is a dog or a cat. Mm-hmm. So a lot of their genetically wired behavior comes into play too. So genetics, motivation, and intelligence at least play a role, and there's probably five other things I'll think of, you know, as soon as I drive away. Yeah.
Okay. And how do people email us, by the way?
Oh, we love it when you email. Great questions like that. I love that question. It's easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org. And we would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah.
You know, what makes an animal trainable?
Yeah, I'd like that idea. And I'd like to hear from you at 1-800-462-7413 if you have a question for us, and someone does. So let's go to that caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kathy from Anchorage, Alaska.
Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it.
Well, I have a 4 or 5-year-old German Shepherd Beagle. We adopted her when she was 2, and since we've had her, she's had this habit of nipping people in the buttock, the lower buttock. So when we have visitors, she keeps a close eye on them. And if I let my guard down, she will go up and just gently nip them in the butt.
This is the kind of problem that it's it's a real problem. You know, it's really not acceptable to have a dog do that, but it's hard not to laugh, isn't it?
It is.
I've got a question for you.
Mostly women.
Oh, especially women? Mostly women. Okay, that's important information. Larry's got a question on his face.
What does a German Shepherd Beagle mix look like?
Well, that's where I started laughing. I started laughing at that part.
Yeah, people get confused. They guess one or the other usually, but she's definitely a German Shepherd brain. She's about 50 pounds, and her hair is mixed between a German Shepherd and a Beagle. It's longer, but it's got the same colors of both.
And do we know for sure that's her heritage, or is that a guess?
It's a guess, but I'll tell you, I have had Beagles for 18 years. So
so you know the inner Beagle.
Yes, I do.
All right, well, what about this inner Beagle here?
Okay, this inner Beagle, outer Shepherd, butt-nipping behavior problem. Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question. Does your dog appear to be somewhat uncomfortable with visitors? And let
Absolutely.
Okay, so sort of watches them, keeps his eye on them, gets a little anxious if they start moving around fast, right?
Yes, okay. And I try to provide guidance and teach her, but I haven't found the right way yet.
What you might want to do is look at sort of both sides of this problem. Is one, the motivation, the emotions behind it, and two, the behavior. So I think I would use both a classical and an operant perspective. You're going to use both kinds of training. One, so the classical is basically to teach her that every time somebody comes, wonderful things happen. So figure out what she loves. Toys would be wonderful, by the way. I think toys are often not used as much as they could be to try and change a dog's emotions. So she loves to play tug of war. She loves to play fetch or something. The visitors are going to come. They're going to stand in the doorway, and they're just going to throw balls for her. You know, you have like a bucket of tennis balls, if she loves balls, or they're going to throw pieces of chicken. But you're going to do this over and over and over again, and how you do this is really important. So I do recommend that you go to a resource. I have a booklet called Cautious Canine. There are others out there that suggest how to go through this procedure, following exactly the right steps in exactly the right time sequence, because the details are just critical. So I would do that. I would also teach her some operant responses, meaning teach her some behaviors that she does on cue. So say, for example, the doorbell rings, and this is not somebody you can say, would you throw a ball 27 times for my dog? Or I would teach her to run into another room and run into a crate or another room when you ask her to. So it's like somebody's at the door, you're really busy, you're feeling a little frantic or harassed, like, you know, we all do sometimes. I want you to be able to say, honey, go to your crate. And she runs in the crate. Go, good girl, good girl. You shut the door. You give her a stuffed toy. She chews on that. You deal with your visitor. So again, she's felt like, well, I like it when visitors come. But you didn't have to deal with a lot of specific training. You sort of prevented the problem at that point.
That's helpful. I like that.
Yeah. Well, good luck. Let us know how it goes.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, a conversation with a raptor rehabilitator who tells us what it's like to help injured birds return to the wild. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Marge Gibson to the program. Marge is a licensed raptor rehabilitator from the Raptor Education Group in Antigo, Wisconsin. Marge, thank you very much for joining us today. How and when did you first become interested in wildlife rehabilitation?
You know, I don't remember a time when I wasn't interested in birds, and my mother had all these little pictures in my, you know, in my little picture book about, you know, me being outside feeding birds about the time I could walk, and so, you know, it was always a part of who I was, and the rest really came naturally.
Tell us about the birds that you rescue now. What kind of birds, and how many do you take in every year? What's it like?
Well, these days, we do an awful lot of bald eagles, a lot of raptors, which are hawks, owls, and eagles, and vultures. And we also do a large number of passerines, which are the smaller perching birds, many of which are endangered, and swans, cranes, pretty much anything with feathers ends up here at our facility.
So even though it says raptor rehabilitation, you're like happy to take in anything with feathers, it sounds like. Well, good for you.
Well, you know, the name was created when we moved back to, I'm from Antigo, but we were living in Southern California for a number of years. And then when we moved back in 1990, I did want to create an education facility, and I wanted to, you know, write books and that sort of thing. And it seems like, you know, the field of dreams. I mean, once we built a facility and started taking a few birds for rehabilitation, it just sort of, you know, the storm gates opened, and we haven't figured out how to shut it off.
You know, I'm wondering, what is there a type of injury that's more prevalent than another that you treat with your birds?
You know, most of the things that we see, about 90% or 95% are human-related, and that includes anything from the smaller birds, you know, caught by cat, to shootings, even though they're illegal, hit windows, a lot of poisonings. We use a lot of things on our grass and on our flowers, and we're not really thinking ahead that, you know, the birds eat those same insects that, you know, that fall off. And so I would say poisonings, shootings, and caught by cat would probably be the biggest.
The biggest thing. Can you tell us about a recent case you had? I think it would be interesting to know maybe what kind of bird you treated and how long it took to recover from its injury. Give us that.
Well, recently we've had a lot of starving owls coming in. In fact, we had 43 in the clinic up to last week. And the reason that they were starving is because we had a very difficult winter. We had very deep snow up here in the Northland with ice layers between, and they were not able to access the mice and rats that they normally eat. Because of the ice layers, they couldn't snow plunge as they did. And many of them came in less than half their normal weight, which is extremely critical, as you can imagine. And it takes, we have to tube feed them, give them liquid food for at least 2 to 3 weeks, depending on how severe their starvation is. And then it takes probably 2 or 3 months for them to develop their muscles back again, so they're well flighted and they're 100% when they leave us. So, you know, I would say most situations, a lot of lead poisoning also in bald eagles, and we've had several recent bald eagle lead poisonings, and it takes anywhere from 3 months to a year to get those birds back into the wild.
Wow, so many questions your answers bring up. One question I had is, why do you have to tube feed the starving owls?
Well, they're not able to digest whole food. It's as if a person were an anorexic or were starving and went into the hospital, you know, they wouldn't serve you a steak because you wouldn't be able to digest it. And they're at that point where even if they were able to catch, you know, a mouse or whatever, they wouldn't be able to digest it. Their body has already started to shut down.
Wow. So you pre-digest it for them,
basically.
We do, basically.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're an all-service facility.
Talk about that flight training, by the way. How do you prepare these birds for their final release into the wild?
Well, if they're adults, they have the skills, the life skills of learning how to catch prey and those things already logged into their brain. But what they need there is a large area for really physical therapy. So we have a really huge flight building, and they're able to basically do physical therapy back and forth until they, you know, they build up their muscles. And when we think about a bird, most of their chest muscle is used for flight. And if they are starving, they've lost all of that, and they have to rebuild it before they're accurate in flight and do all those things, including, you know, catch dinner their first night out. So it's really important that they be well exercised and conditioned.
Is that part of why it can take so long? You mentioned sometimes it can take even up to a year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly part of it. The other part is when they have poisonings, and I mentioned the lead poisoning, there's often neurologic problems that occur with that, sometimes cardiac problems with a sustained lead poisoning, and they have to be treated and come out of that just as if, you know, a human was involved with the same sort of situation. So it's medicine. It's, you know, it's good medicine. Certainly our patients are different than in a human hospital, but we do the same sort of procedures.
And when you recover these birds and they're back to good health, I know it takes a long time and you have to be really patient, but it must be quite a sight to and a feeling to finally see them fly away free.
Well, you know, that's the most amazing part of the work that we do and, of course, why we do it. People are always saying to me, don't you miss them when they're gone? You know, it must be hard to release them. And, you know, you've been through a lot with them, and but you're doing it so they can be free again. And I always say, you know, it would be nice if they would drop a postcard now and again. But, you know, it's sort of like packing your kids off to college. You know, you're going to miss them, but you won't miss the laundry.
You've done this so many times. Do you still get a little damp in the eye when they fly away? It makes me just sort of wussy just thinking about it.
You know, each and every time I... you know, we have, you know, very good days and very bad days, as you can imagine.
Oh, bad.
And I've done this for well over 40 years now, and it really doesn't change. Every patient is just like the first one.
Oh.
And there's the, you know, the joy of seeing their milestones and the, you know, the incredible sadness when they're not going to make it in the wild. But absolutely, when they're released, it is really joyful. And it's, you know, you just wish for them to a long and happy natural life, and you've done your part, and you've just given them a second chance.
Of the various birds you see, do you find that some species are better patients than others?
Oh, yes.
She laughs.
Oh, yes.
I think that's a yes.
Yeah. You know, there's some that are just have a lot of natural wild spirit. Loons, for instance, are very difficult patients. No part of them wants to be in rehab. and they're not really easily adaptable, as our herons, great blue herons, are not really easily adaptable. But some of them, like bald eagles, like, you know, some of the, I hate to use the word intelligent, but a lot of the predators, I mean, just because of the way that they are and their need to survive in the wild, they really sort of analyze everything, and they if they're well handled, they really respond well.
You know, I seem to recall that sometimes the birds will help other birds in the rehabilitation process, as a matter of fact. I think you have an owl that will do that.
It's amazing. I have, in fact, all of my raptors, whether they're bald eagles or hawks or owls, are all raised, if we get orphans in, are all raised by their own species. And that prevents imprinting to humans, and they have the proper vocalizations and the proper behaviors that are meant for survival skills, of course, once they're released into the wild. So they come in, but they don't know that they're in captivity, basically. We supply the food, we supply, you know, a sort of a nest structure, and the foster parents really do the rest. And it's always amazing to me that they just, you know, that they don't skip a beat. I mean, they don't have to be theirs biologically. They're the most excellent parents. They also don't have to be females. We have a wonderful male bald eagle that is just, you know, dad of the year. You know, I keep saying someday I'm gonna write for, you know, they have father of the year and
right.
for Father's Day,
right.
And you know, he's just incredible. Very patient, very tactile with their youngsters. Their beaks are always on them and sort of nurturing and preening. But they're very patient and just the best sort of parents that you could ever hope for.
And I want you to give us a perspective on just how much it takes. Let's just talk about food for just a second. How much food do you have to provide the birds that you work with?
You know, that's a really interesting subject, and one that we've actually, yesterday we were trying to go over it. Young great horned owls, for instance, and we have, you know, orphans coming in right now at about 3 weeks. Eat between 13 and 17 mice a day each, depending on their gender. And we buy the mice. They're 55 cents a piece plus shipping, and the shipping is killer. I mean, the shipping is like $75 for, you know, for a shipment coming out of Indiana or Minnesota where we can get them. So it's incredibly, incredibly expensive and getting more so all the time. But, you know, we buy 400 pounds of beef heart every 2 weeks. And depending on, you know, how many eagles we have in, we either are donated fish. Sometimes people, you know, catch fish that they don't want to clean, or they, you know, were just having fun catching them and didn't intend to eat them but kept them. And we certainly take donations of that kind. You know, hit by car, deer, you know, we're here, you know, cutting up deer often, you know, to get enough food for our birds. We have had as high as 36 eagles here at one time, so we have a real food a food crisis almost all of the time, and it's getting more of an issue.
You know, but I'll bet in spite of food crises, I'll bet you there are people listening who would really be interested in learning how to become a wildlife rehabilitator. What's important for them to consider, and how might they go about doing that?
You know, first of all, it is incredibly important that we get more people that are interested in and will do wildlife rehabilitation. There are classes. International Wildlife Rehabilitation Council has classes, and many of them are online. National Wildlife Rehabilitation also is an organization that has classes, and you can have material and go to conferences, which are all very good. We, in our state, we have permits. We're state permitted as well as federally for avian species. And we have a 1,200-hour minimum of doing an internship with someone and or volunteering. And I would suggest that they volunteer at a facility to just get an idea of what they're getting themselves into. And, you know, the hours are long, and, you know, vacations are few. But the truth is that it's something that really needs to be done, and it is a very wonderful part of life once you're in it.
Where can our listeners find resources about wildlife rehabilitation if they, let's say, they encounter an injured animal in their community?
You know, it's hard to get information, and I'll be the first to admit that. But, you know, calling your local sheriff's department, they often know rehabilitators in your area because they bring us birds a lot. And calling other rehabilitators that, you know, that are, that you know are active to try to get information in your area.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you today, and we'll put your website up on our website. And would you mind sending us some pictures, too?
That no. I will send you as many pictures as you want.
Great. We'll put some.
Yeah, we have one thing we have here is we have plenty of wonderful subjects for photos. So,
if you have a photo of your nanny bald eagle daddy, I would love to see a picture of him.
I do.
Great.
I do. He's just incredible.
Thank you, Marge.
Thank you so much.
Marge Gibson is a licensed raptor rehabilitator with the Raptor Education Group in Antigo, Wisconsin. She joined us today from her home in Antigo. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of For the Love of a Dog by our own Patricia McConnell. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and one lucky winner will be selected at random to win a copy of For the Love of a Dog by Patricia McConnell. And here's today's question. At the age of 11, Marge Gibson was presented with an injured harrier. When nobody at her local conservation office was willing to help her save the bird, she decided to take matters into her own hands. And this was just one of the many events that ultimately inspired her to go into raptor rehabilitation. Now, harriers are birds of prey that belong to the genus Circus, which refers to the circling movements the birds make when doing what? What is that?
Dancing with the stars.
If you think you know the answer, don't say dancing with the stars.
I've got that one already. I got dibs on that one.
Call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. And to find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org. We'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And if you'd like to join us now, the number 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello.
Hi, who are we speaking with?
My name is Rob, and I'm in Glen Allen, Virginia.
Rob, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have the fat cat, skinny cat scenario. We have two cats. Both are adopted. Both are about 2.5 years old. And both are Duluth Calicos. And if it wasn't for the fact that one weighs about 17 pounds and the other weighs about 8 pounds, it would be very hard to tell them apart.
See, Jack Spratt could eat no fat, and his wife could eat no lean. I've got this image of
Well, the fat cat that we are really having some trouble with, she was originally an outdoor cat and was relatively fit and thin. But we don't live in an environment where we felt comfortable letting her out, so mm-hmm. She has now become an indoor cat. Obviously, they're both indoor cats. They do not eat out of the same bowl. They have two separate bowls. We've taken the overweight cat to the vet. We have tried some prescription weight watchers
mm-hmm.
food,
mm-hmm.
but we still have the fat cat and the skinny cat. So,
and so you need a workout plan. You need a health club.
Well,
we
got that too. We just had two children, two babies, and the oldest is 2 years old, and we're trying to encourage him to chase her around.
Ooh, I don't know if I do that. I can see the benefit and to some extent, but I'm not sure. That might lead to another behavioral problem. You're calling us about cat attacking two-year-old. Probably not a good idea. I have a cat. I should actually confess here. My name is Patricia McConnell, and I have a cat who's a little bit overweight. She doesn't weigh 17 pounds, but she's got a little punch on her. And so she and I are both on a little bit of a diet. So I'm quite sympathetic. My sushi has eaten a little too few many sushis. But so here's something that I learned when looking into my cat's physical fitness program is that there's some people who recommend that rather than using dried kibble, even if it's dietary kibble, which is what I give sushi, for cats who are overweight, to actually giving them a higher percentage of canned food. Canned food tends to have more protein, less carbohydrates, and protein. Cats are, you know, pretty much protein black holes. Mm-hmm. They are true carnivores. And the higher amount of protein satisfies their hunger and actually causes them to eat a little bit less. So I've actually been giving my little kitty more canned food. The other thing is, as you've talked about, an exercise program with your two-year-old. How much exercise does Fat Cat get right now?
Well, the two cats play together quite a bit, and she has gotten to the point now where she can actually jump over the baby gates.
Oh, so she's getting better. Does she eat free choice? How do you monitor the amount of food that she eats?
We measure it in the morning and in the evening.
Okay. So she's been getting, anyway, historically more calories than she's been using up. So.
And you're sure she's not eating the skinny cat food?
The skinny cat
food.
She may eat just a little bit of what is left over, but I think you're right, Patricia, in that she's gotten fat and now she's reached an equilibrium.
So you're going to need to decrease the amount of calories that she actually eats. And, you know, Larry's point is a really important one, is that you're feeding two cats. You know, who finishes first? They have separate bowls, but who finishes first? So I would feed her as many small multiple meals as often as you can manage, but I want you to monitor them. I want you to feed, and this is another reason why pure meat and canned food is good, because cats tend to eat it a little faster. And so you can get both of them getting a meal in, and then they both get the amount of food that they're supposed to get. You might want to put their bowls farther away. It also makes it a little easier for them both to finish. So you're sure Skinny Cat is getting all of the food that she should eat?
Right.
So you just, you know, it's just calories in, calories used. It's just like us.
That's right.
But think about that, the food source, and think about protein versus carbohydrates. That might be a helpful tip.
And good luck.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Rob. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. And we have another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Julia.
And Julia, where are you from?
Gordonsville, Virginia.
Julia, thanks a lot for calling, and how can we help?
Well, I have a about 12-year-old house cat. She's a wonderful little, very affectionate cat, and she does one thing that I find very annoying, which is in the middle of the night, I don't mind that she sleeps at the foot of the bed, but at the middle of the night, repeatedly, she creeps up to my pillow. And I will, put my hand underneath her and lift her up very gently, put her at the other end of the bed and say no. And it's so funny because if I'm awake, I can literally hear her creeping toward my pillow. And I don't understand when I say no. I know it's hard to train cats, but what can I do about this?
You know, it's sometimes not as hard to train cats as we might think. But here's the deal. Just saying no
is not enough.
Have I heard that before? You know, so let's think about that. She creeps up a little bit, and then you said, you sweet thing, you gently pick her up and you gently put her back, and then you say, and you've got such a sweet voice, I'm sure you say something like, no.
Well,
right?
After about the fifth time, it's not so gentle.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, right?
Right.
So here's my suggestion. Basically, what we're talking about here is punishment. You're trying to do something that makes creeping up and sleeping on your face aversive. But one of the problems with punishment, we know this from a lot of research from the 40s and 50s, is that one of the problems with punishment is if you start with something just sort of a little bit aversive, what happens is the animal habituates to it. And so you bump it up just a little bit, and then it's like, then they get used to that. And then you bump it up a little bit. So you're basically training her to get used to a continuum of no, 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 right? So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go instantly, right away, to something that's much more, let's say, going to get her attention. I don't want you to hurt her. I don't want you to scare her. But here's my suggestion. You said you can hear her starting to creep. That's when you need to take action. And what I want you to do is just thrash around the bed as if you just, I don't know, saw a ghost or something. You know? So she starts to creep, and you go,
Gotcha. Right? Okay. Yeah.
And then you just go right back to sleep.
Yeah.
Like you could. But you pretend, right? But basically, you're going to take action as soon as she starts the behavior. Every behavior has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
And you've got to get her attention at the beginning.
Yeah. So basically, by the time she gets up there, she's already won.
Exactly.
That's
right. She's been reinforced.
Uh-huh.
So she hasn't won, but you've lost.
Yeah. Sleep.
Right.
Well, yes. Julia, give that a try, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And Patricia, thank you so much for all that great advice.
Oh, it's my pleasure, as usual.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0510P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.